Histories. This recording is the next in our series of oral history interviews with local immigrants or descendants of local immigrants in honor of Oregon's sesquicentennial celebration. Initially, these interviews were done with high school students at Sunset High School, but the number of people wanting to tell their story has been so great, we've continued to record the interviews at the library as well. This interview is with Chan Noon, who lived under the Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia before fleeing, living for 4 years in a refugee camp, and then immigrating to the U.S. after that. His story is powerful and an interesting look at our recent history. All right, my name is Mark Richardson. I'm a librarian at the Cedar Mill Community Library, and I'm here today with Chan, and Chan's going to tell us a little bit about his story. So go ahead and tell us your name and a little bit about where you're from.
Okay. My name is Chan Noon, last name N-O-U-N, spelled like noun, but it's actually Noon. I grew up in Cambodia. I came to America in 1988 at the age of 28 as a refugee. And I came here 20 years ago, but where I came from, it was a different country at the time. It was the peak of the Cold War. Before coming to America, I spent about 4 years in various refugee camps along Thai-Cambodian borders.
Okay. So you said it was 1988?
It was 1988, December 1988, when I came here.
Okay.
But I didn't come to Portland, Oregon the first time. I went to St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay.
In 1988, and I lived there for about almost 9 years before moving to Oregon in 1997. And I'm currently living in Aloha, and I have a daughter that's now married.
Okay.
And
great.
I'm working in downtown Portland as an accountant.
Oh, really? Okay. So why did you settle in St. Paul? What were the circumstances?
True for all other people who came as a refugee, when I was accepted to come to America, we had no idea where we would end up with. We had no choice. St. Paul, where they actually found someone who was willing to help me start a new life. So you really don't have a choice where you're going to end up with.
Okay.
You know, 3 days before you had to leave the refugee camps, they called you in and they say you're going to go to St. Paul. And then they pull up the U.S. map and say, this is where St. Paul, Minnesota is, and it's cold and there's a lot of mosquito. And that's where you ended up with. So it's based on where they would find someone who would be willing to help you start a new life. That's where they ship you to.
Okay.
So you really don't have a choice.
So was it another Cambodian person who was willing to help, or was it just...
No, actually, there was a Caucasian family.
Oh, okay.
They were in their 50s and 60s. The husband named Richard Lefsey, and he was in his mid-60s. And his wife, Corrine Lefsey, she was in her 57 when I first came. So, and they had two grown kids, so they kind of didn't have young children to take care of. But she's been helping refugee families in the past.
Oh, okay.
But so she kind of involved with helping in settling refugees. So
did you live with them for a while?
I lived with them for 1 year. When I first came, they let me stay with them for 1 year. And then after that, I moved out. But I still go back and forth. And when I was going to school, when I want something to eat, when I need to do something, it's more like home, even though I left there. But they let me stay with them for 1 year.
And how old were you again?
I was 28 years
old. You were 28.
28
okay.
And a half. I was born in 1960, on June 1st, 1960. So by the time I came to the U.S., I'm almost well over 28.
And so before you came here, you said you were in a refugee camp for 4 years?
Yeah, I escaped Cambodia in 1984. And I spent almost 4 years in various camps along Thai-Cambodian borders. And so from the time I left the country, by the time I got to the U.S. was almost 4 years. So I spent a lot of time, from one refugee camp, and then we lived in that camp for a while. That camp got attacked, so we moved to another camp, we ran away to another camp, and finally we ended up in a camp inside Thailand, about 6 miles inside Thailand, and where I was in that camp for probably about two and a half years, before I was accepted to come to the U.S.
So what were the camps like?
The refugee camp is through like any other refugee camp. Right now, we would look at Darfur camp and all that, it's pretty much the same. As it's like a prison, open air, you know, a prison. Living condition is bad. Shorts of water, shorts of food, you know, food and supply and stuff are very limited. We got ration food from the UN, HCR, which is UN High Commissioner for Refugee. All that ration food that we receive is just enough to keep you alive. It's not enough to really keep you well. And you know, I know it, you know, there's some little schooling for children to go into. But you know, overall, it's an upgrade, you know, to a prison.
Oh, from what you were living in before.
It's an it's an open air, but you know, it's a desperate situation, and but that's the whole point. And I mean, the sad part is a lot of people who were there. I mean, the future is uncertain. You don't really know where you're gonna end it up with, whether you get to come to America or whether you get rounded up back and then shipped back to Cambodia. But that's a really hard part. So not many people who actually were there with me who ended up coming here. Maybe one third of the people were actually ended up in other, you know, countries. And two thirds of it were actually returned to Cambodia later on, four or five years after I got here. So we still one of the lucky ones. I'm still one of the lucky ones to be able to, on the day that I went in for the screening to come to U.S., out of 47 cases, it's only 17 was accepted, you know, and 30 cases were actually rejected. So it's not that everyone in a refugee camp ever get out of the camps and ended up somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So it's a desperate situation. But it's just like I said, I mean, the saddest part is that you don't really have any hope. It's just because you're not really sure what's going to happen. It's not like you know that after you've been there for so many years, you know you're going to get out and do something else.
Right.
So you just hope, and it's just the only thing is it, and then it's a relatively safe camp from, you know, being attacked.
The
one inside Thailand, we still worried about security, but not as much as the one on Cambodian borders.
Right. Okay. So, well, maybe you can tell us a little bit about when you got to the U.S., what were the biggest challenges that you faced?
When I got to the U.S., the biggest challenge, I'm sure probably many people will face the same thing, is language. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a little English in the refugee camp, you know, but I learned English from the Cambodian teachers, and that's a book English. So it's a whole different kind. And when I first got here, I mean, I could read a little more, but you know, listening skill is still a really hard thing. When I first got here, American speak English with all kinds of idioms, it's kind of expression with it, and a lot of things I've never heard it. You know,
right.
And also they speak fast. And a lot of time I ended up, you know, saying something people couldn't understand me, and then when I grab a piece of paper and write it down, and they say, oh, this is how it's say, you know, you're not supposed to say that, this is how you pronounce it. So all that, so it's just the main challenge to me is learning the language. But looking back now, 20 years later, I thought I was lucky that I was taken in by the American family. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I would have, there's a lot of people who came here at the same age as me, who still now, after being in America for 20 years, could not speak and use the language as well as I do. And I think the problem is because they didn't, I came in and I was taken in by an American family. I had no choice but to learn to speak English.
Right.
So English is the only way. I can't talk to anybody else in Cambodian. I couldn't talk to anybody else out in my language. So I was forced or encouraged to use the language all the time. The people I were with, my host, my sponsor, were also very helpful. Every night we would sit down at the dining table going through all these, you know, idiomatic expressions and all of that. So it's learning the language. There was one occasion that right now that when I told the story, they thought it was funny. You know, a few days after I got there, then one of their friends came to visit, and after they sat down for a while having coffee, and then she started looking at watch and said, well, it's time for me to hit the road. And you know, I know the word hit and I know the word road, and I was actually, you know, literally waiting to see what she was going to do. And I thought, is she going to take a stick and bit the road or something? And then she just suddenly got out of the house and got in the car and drove off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I told him later, people thought it was funny, but that kind of thing, because you know the word, but it's just every people here speak, sprinkle with all this kind of idiom, automatic expression. So that is the most challenging thing. Besides that, it was not really a hard thing, because I'm not sure how much you know about Cambodia, but we had a terrible past.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is maybe you could tell us a little bit about the circumstances there.
We went through a lot of hardship. So in terms of physical hardship, learning how to make life here in America was not the main thing. So the language problem is probably the most challenging thing. But looking back, I got great people who really helped me, and you know, ready to make sure that I, you know, get into the new culture and everything.
Right. I don't know a ton about Cambodian history, but you know, I know it's tied in with Vietnam and the Vietnam War to a certain degree. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what the circumstances were for you, you know, growing up.
Yeah, you know, like I said, when I was a kid, Cambodia was a peaceful country in the 60s. And I was born in 1960, it was a peaceful country, and life was actually relatively good compared to, you know, we had food to eat, we're not starving, we didn't, you know, we got schooling, we do things normal like anybody else in the world. Our life is not the same standard as the U.S. But then in the late 60s, the Vietnam War spilled over to Cambodia. As a result of Nixon's and Kissinger policy to bomb Cambodia, because, you know, all that thing. So it spilled over to Cambodia, and then Cambodia had a coup, and then the Civil War broke out in 1970. And between the government, who was supported by the American, which is the U.S., and then the another group called the Khmer Rouge, which is a guerrilla, you know, group, started out to fight the French, you know, colonials. In the colonies, and then later on became a powerful force after the American, you know, had a coup and kicked out the king over the country. So the full-scale civil war broke out in 70, and after 5 years, the group called the Khmer Rouge won the war. But within those 5 years, you know, our family, you know, by 1973, when I was 13, our town was destroyed, and we had run around from town to town. We live in one village, one town, and we got attacked. We tried to go to school there for a few months, and we got attacked. We moved again, and after 5 years, we ended up in another town near Thai Cambodian border, not too far from Thai Cambodian border. And the war was over in 1975. And when the Khmer won the war, they just turned the country upside down. They turned the country clock by the year zero and just got rid of everybody who educated and used to live in the city. So they basically emptied the city. They kicked everybody out of the city, and then nobody lived in the city except themselves. And then we all were put in the jungle and the forest doing labor, farming, overwork, tortures, starvations, and all that. You can name it, whatever the... I told people it was hell on earth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that ran on for about a period of 4 years. We went through starvation. We were forced to work every day, 7 days a week, dusk to dawn. We don't know what day it is. And we, you know, got rampant disease and all kinds of disease, sick. People died left and right. And by that time, and in 1979, the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia. The Vietnamese invasion kind of got rid of the Khmer Rouge. And by the time the Khmer Rouge was done, almost over 2 million Cambodians was killed. We call it Cambodian genocide back then. So after the Vietnamese invaded in 79, I was still, you know, I was able to go back to the town where I came from, lived there for a while, and then in 1984 I escaped from Cambodia to the camp and spent until 88 I got to come here. So we, you know, from when the Khmer took over, I was 15 years old. So from the 15 to 19, that's when the Khmer were occupied. So we had no schooling, there's no religion, anything. Anything that a civilization ever had, is Khmer wiped it all out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, there's no schooling, there's abandoned religion, there's nobody go to school, nobody practice religion, and everybody starve. And what the way they did is they just turned one class of people, one group of people, against another group. People like me was on the government side, which is on the government that was supported by the U.S. So those people, when they actually won the war, they actually wanted to wipe out those population.
Right.
And the people who were supported them during the war, during the Civil War, was, you know, granted all the privilege, and which is mostly people who live in the jungle, people who live in a remote area, people who actually were actually illiterate, you know, didn't know much of anything. So mm-hmm. basically, you're just telling two classes of people, you know, while we were all pressed to work, overworked, starving,
mm-hmm.
those people having to eat and have to eat. So you have a population who are well-fed and a population who is starved, is walking like a, you know, like a skeleton,
mm-hmm.
walking, many people dying left and right. So, so we were put into a really, really bad, you know, situation, and people died left and right, and during that 4 years, and we've seen so many, so many deaths.
Yeah.
And destruction. I mean, people ask me, you know, have you ever seen dead people? I told them, I've seen people like road kills, dead body by road kills. The massive killing field of thousands of people. The people died left and right in the camp. People were taken out and killed right in front of everything they done was public style execution, public style tortures, everything. It's just they were trying to break down your spirits.
Right.
You would never want to challenge them. So that's why it's connected to coming to the U.S. I mean, in terms of, I've been physically and mentally pushed to the limit
right.
during that 4 years period. So in terms of handling hardships and all that thing, it wasn't too bad.
Right.
So coming to America, it was like, to me, like relief.
Relief.
Yeah. Might like you have your life again. You get all the freedom. You do have to work hard. You do have to learn the language. You do have to go to school working full time. I was going to school full time, working full time
mm-hmm.
in a different language, and I was still happy.
Yeah.
So you compare
because you
do it for yourself, and here you were forced to work by in the community. Time you were forced to work all day long without even having enough food mm-hmm. to eat, and here you work for yourself. And so life is all relative. You know, when you used to do that kind of work and coming to America, it wasn't too hard at all.
Right.
The only challenge is the brain part, which is learning the language. But when you master that part of it, it wasn't a hardship, which is, it's not true with other people who came from European country or came from a peaceful country who fly in here, you know, regularly, but, you know, not came through what I did.
Right.
But the way I came from, you know, kid asked me all the time when I talked in high school, he said, was it hard coming to America? You know, to me, it was a piece of cake. I mean, you go to work hard, you go to school, you earn money for yourself, you came home, you have enough food to eat, you got a warm shower to take. You know, during the Khmer Rouge, I worked all day long, dusk to dawn, and came without having enough food to eat.
Right.
We wouldn't have anything.
Yeah.
And here you work for yourself. So it wasn't that hard at all.
Yeah. So when you said in the late 70s, Vietnam kicked out the Khmer Rouge?
Yeah, in 1979, the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia.
So between that time and the time you escaped, what were things like?
After the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia, they at the same time they kicked out the Khmer Rouge. But the Khmer Rouge didn't stop then, didn't die. They just pulled themselves to the border, to the jungle border between Cambodians and Thailand.
Okay.
So they still regrouped, but it was a small force now. They're not able to rule the country. And then the government that was installed by the Vietnamese, Vietnamese occupation allowed people to go back to where they came from, because during the Khmer Rouge they evacuated mm-hmm. people from the city, they forced people out of the city, so
right.
everybody's shifting around the country to the jungle. So the new government, and that was the puppet government by the Vietnamese occupation, let us go back to the town. So we all would go back, a lot of people, massive people traveling back and forth on the street, a lot of starving, you know, and chaotic same moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came back to the town where we started out and started to make a living. And I was there for another 4 years. Life was a lot better than the Khmer Rouge, but the freedom was still very limited because the new government was still a communist government.
Right.
Yeah, at that time it was still in the peak of the Cold War. you were still not allowed to learn a certain thing, not to learn English, not to practice anything, not to listen to VOA, the signal was jammed. It was still a communist world. It's like a propaganda, but in terms of moving around, you're not so much restricted. You were able to have access to moving around, travel around to places. Your school started again, and religion started again. You can practice religion. It's coming back, but it's but it's still not on the level before the war started.
Right.
But at least it's a lot. Twice as that's better than during the Khmer Rouge. People were allowed to practice religion. Children were allowed to go to school. People were allowed to own property. People were allowed to make a living. It's just when it comes to freedom, it's limited. And then I think it's true like Cuba or anything in North Korea and any communist country.
Right.
They use that as a way to keep people from uprising.
So now,
against the government.
Is the Khmer Rouge, was it more of a political movement or was it a...
The Khmer Rouge was like a guerrilla war. The Khmer Rouge regrouped and tried to fight guerrilla war again. The government in Cambodia, which is supported by the Vietnamese occupation, is the puppet government. And the sad part is that the American played a big role in this. American and the Western government was supplying arms to the Khmer Rouge to fight the Vietnamese occupation. Because even though after they know that the Khmer Rouge slaughtered over 2 million people, because they hate the Vietnamese more than they hate the Khmer Rouge. And that's the American policy, the Western policy. So the Khmer Rouge was actually retreated to the jungle area, try to fight guerrilla war. And the Western government still supported the Khmer Rouge, still let the Khmer Rouge sit at the UN, the UN seat of Cambodia was still awarded to the Khmer Rouge. And we're still supplying, saying, because we hated the Vietnamese. We lost the war to me. We had a lot of bad things with the Vietnamese. We didn't like the Vietnamese, even though the Vietnamese actually literally saved Cambodia or get Cambodian back on their feet. But the bad part is that after knowing that what the Khmer Rouge did, and we were still supporting them.
Yeah.
So we supported them until 1993, when the Cambodian had what they call a Paris Peace Accord, where all the Cambodian faction decided to sit down and had an election, so UN step in and help set up that election. So the Khmer Rouge was still supported by the Western country. And after what they done, and after the problem was all exposed to the whole world, that they done horrible things in Cambodia.
Right.
And that is a sad part.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to go back at
all?
Yeah,
I have gone back several times. The first time was 1999. You know what? That's an interest. You know, when I first came to Americas, I never wanted to go back.
Right.
Because all you remember about that place was hell. The suffering, everything that you can imagine happened on earth, all the terrible things happened there. So I even, told my family, a survivor family, to say, I really don't want to go back. I was happy with my life here. I go to school full time, working full time. I'm still happy. And then, as a human, when you get a little older, further down, when you get all this, we get your life together, when you start building up your life, and your life is all built up, and you have everything you need. And then, you get older, you start to think about the places. And then you miss your people, your parents, and all that. So I decided to go back. So the first time I'd gone back to Cambodia was 16 years after I left. But I could have gone back earlier, but I chose not to. I never really wanted to, because all you had about that place is bad memories.
Right.
Yeah, but then when you first gone back there in 1999, in December 99, when you got back there, you see the people, your faces, the people who, you used to be one of them.
Right.
Used to be one of them. You share the same suffering, you share the same feeling, and you know how they feel, you know everything about them, and you came back. You start thinking about them a lot, so just keep going back. Once you go back, just keep going back. So I've been back about 5 times since then, and the first time I've gone back, my father is still alive, but he died a few years ago, and I still have a mother and 2 sisters
okay.
in Cambodia. So I've gone back and you know, just like I said, when you've gone back one, you see these people, you know what it is, and you used to be one, you just keep coming back.
Right.
You just can't forget them anymore. So,
but, so what's the government like there now?
Cambodia is still it's at peace now in terms of you could go back anytime, you can travel anywhere you want. But the government that is sitting in Cambodia now was the government that was pretty much installed by the Vietnamese.
Okay.
Yeah, the UN had an election in 1993. The government was not elected, lost the election, but they didn't give up power. And they still hold power anyway. So even though technically it's supposed to be a democratic country, but it's still a dictatorship,
right.
Except that people gain more freedom, gain more access to freedom. People were able to do it's somewhat modified, and I think it's true like in Vietnam too, that the communist government relaxed restriction a little bit,
mm-hmm.
so that people were able to do a lot more things than what it is. The only thing that's still strict, I think, North Korea is in Cuba, but the rest is pretty much it's more of a free world, but it's still run by the same people, but they changed the way they run, just like China,
you know,
it opened up a little bit, so the Chinese government was not ruling the country like the way during the Cultural Revolution.
Right.
They change the way they give people more freedom, more access, open to trade, free trade and all that thing. So it is good. It's just not, it's, of course there's a lot more room to improve.
Right.
And but it's a lot better than what it used to be.
Yeah.
But it's still worse than when I was a kid.
Okay. So while you've been in the US, have you faced any prejudice or things like that?
Oh yeah. I think that's true with anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? You know, I some people had that, run into that experience and then think that was a bad thing. But to me, it's a whole different thing. I have a different outlook on that thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
of course, when I first came, I put in the Midwest, and then I had run into people yell racial slur at me and say something. You know, why you doing here? You know, shit. But again, it's all word stuff. I mean, nobody really take any action, try to attack me, try to hurt me or anything like
mm-hmm.
that. And I came from a country where our own people commit terrible atrocities.
Right.
And you can't expect to come to a new place, a new country, and then expect that thing didn't happen. Because if that thing even happened in your own country, even in your own country, people still look down at you, people still hate you.
With your own people.
So, but I still believe that there's a lot more. America is still a much better, better place, better society. Even though what I ran into was just an isolated, incident. It's all just wood. Maybe some young teenagers, after they get so much to drink and they just get bored or they do something stupid. But nobody really tried to take me down.
Right.
At least for me. But maybe other people had a different experience. But for me, nobody really tried to hurt me or anything like that. But I look at it, even this thing could happen anywhere, even in my own country,
right.
with my own people who speak the same language, it looks the same.
Right.
So I don't really take that as a big issue.
Okay.
Yeah. And because I ran into more good people in this country than like the people who took me in. A lot of people in the Midwest, in Minnesota, who actually took me in, who got me to where I am today, they really changed my life.
Yeah.
And they had nothing to do with me. They don't look like me. They never knew me before. They opened their door unconditionally.
Mm-hmm.
They supported me, especially my sponsor that took me in.
Yeah.
I mean, I came here at age 28. I was all the way well past my age to go to school, and the last time I went to school was 1975.
Mm-hmm.
It's 15 years old, and I could have been put in a factory to work, but the fact that when I first came, they asked me, what do you want to do? Do you want to go to school or you want to go to work? At the age of 28, almost 29, and you go to school, you go to work, what else can you do? You don't have any skill, but you probably
right.
end up in the factory, working in the assembly line. But then I said I wanted to go to school because I been out of school for a long time, and they supported me and walked me through the GED process, enrolled me in community college, learning English and all that, and they don't have the money to give it to me, but they're there to support me all the time.
Yeah.
And that one decision that they made has really changed my life. Mm-hmm. And my life turned out the way it is here in America just because the activist people did.
Right.
You know, they could have just sent me somewhere else. Because when you first came, you don't really know what to do. You have to depend on the people who took you in.
Right.
You know, whatever they do is actually shaped your life.
Mm-hmm.
Shaped your life. And now.
So what do you like about living in Oregon?
Well, I like it. You know, we were in the Midwest, and it's nice. It's also nice, but it's cold. You know, after a while, you get tired of that. But here in Oregon, I think number one is the scenery. You know, you can have different landscape. You don't have to go so far away to get to different landscape. You can go to the mountain. You can go to the beach. You can go to things.
Right.
And you don't have to go far. But the climate is mild. Yeah. And even though it rained and in the winter. But I like it here. I like it here. And the reason we ended up here because it was two Cambodian family who was in the refugee camp with me ended up here.
Oh, okay.
See?
Oh,
so,
nice.
You know, when we were looking for a place to move, and we said, oh, we better move to some place where we know people. So we decided to come here. We had no idea about what Oregon is. And so we just get tired of cold, we'll pack it up, and we came here. And,
yeah.
So, but we like it here, and we've been here over 11 years now, since 1997.
Is there a pretty strong Cambodian community here?
Yeah, pretty strong. There's a few thousand Cambodian people here in Oregon. It's in Portland area and Southwest Washington.
Okay.
And it's a smaller community compared to other states, compared to California or you know, Massachusetts.
Right.
Even in Minnesota. But it's got a good good community, and they do all kinds of things, you know.
Okay. Now you talked about missing the people of your native country. Is that primarily the thing that you miss from Cambodia?
Yeah. That's the only thing. You know, to me, I told people this a number of times, but that's, you know, to me, it's not the land, the way I live. You know, I don't get tied to the land. I tied to the people.
Right.
You know, in the Midwest, I go every year to see the old folks who used to support me.
Right.
And again, after these people gone, I probably don't have good reason to go. It's not so much the landscape or vacation, but I like to go see them. It's the people, the connection. You know, when you go see these people and you remember when the time, because my life would not have been here as it is today without these people. So, you know, they're active. It may not be something that they chose to do, or it's just they didn't think that far, but, you know, to be able to go back and visit these people and share the feeling of what you'd done together back then. And so, and same thing in Cambodia, I go there, it's more of a people.
Yeah.
It's the land itself doesn't have much connection, which is, some people have tied to the land, more to the property. But to me, it's the people. It's a people connection.
You know,
you go there, you see these people, and you look at what their life is, and you see that what they have in their household, entire household, less than one third of what they have in your garage, and you know exactly how they feel because you used to be one of them not too long ago. It's not that you're strange. You just born here, and live here. I spent 24 years in Cambodia. Actually, I'm still spending more time in Cambodia than in America. I'm 28 years old. When I got here, I'm 28, and now I'm 48, so I've only been in America for 20 years, but I've been in that country, and including in the refugee camp for 28 years, so I still spend more time over there, so my connection there
is pretty strong.
And
now you said you have children who have gone through the educational system here. What are the main differences that you see from what you had as a child versus what they've had?
You know, I stopped school at eighth grade.
Right.
You know, because of not by choice, because of the war, because of the committee took over and shut down the school. But and where we came from, the school system was a little bit different. We don't really have all the equipment, all the good, you know, knowledge. But the only thing different here is that people in Cambodia are ready to learn. We are more, you know, very motivated to learn because many kids in Cambodia look at education as the only way out of poverty.
Right.
The education is everything. Everybody strive for education. They are ready. They're hungry for knowledge. And here, some kids here in this country find education, schooling is a burden. That is the opposite.
Yeah.
You know, they think that they do it because they had to do it. You know, but where we came from, we're hungry for education because education is the only way out. Like in my case, I didn't come from a very rich family or wealthy family. Our family was just poor, average. I never had the stuff that other people had. I don't have money to spend. My family had enough to give us to eat, but we just are low-end people. We used to go around and sell sweet potato for a living. Mm-hmm. And so schooling is our way out to get out of that. So we, like, you know, people, so kids are cute. And that's one thing about when you go there. See, I have helped a school, a project in Cambodia right now, and a lot of my friends that went there to visit, I told them to go visit the school, and every time people came back, they say the highlights of their trip was going to see the school, because they see these 400, 500, 600 children that was eager to learn.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more happier for you to teach people who are actually willing, ready to learn, you know, ready to absorb everything that you teach them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only difference, is that kids here don't have a lot of motivation, because, and it is true, because they have everything they need. You know, it's not like where we are. In order to have what we want, what we need, you got to go through education.
Right.
So we're ready to learn, and we're just hungry for education. We're looking for way to learn.
Right.
And here, some kid finds school is a burden. That's the only difference. I have a hard time getting my kid to do the same thing. You know,
right.
Just like everybody out, they don't have a lot of motivation, and they just do enough to get by. You know.
Right.
They're not really. And I think because they came back home, they have everything they need, they're not starving, they're not hungry, you know. And when you get what you need, you know, what you want, and it's not much, you really want to do it for yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
So your kids, have they gone back to Cambodia with you?
Or? She's gone back when she was little, but after the age of 12, they don't really want to go anymore. And and I think, you know, I'm not sure, maybe it's true for everyone out, you know, when they go through the teenager period thing, here it is, her world. You know, her cultures. You know, she's born here, grew up here, so it's Cambodia, it's just something you told them, but they're really not, you know, having the connection.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and they're not really interested. A lot of time, kids were not interested in their parents, where they came from, or their parent history, until their parents gone. And then until they become parents themselves, then they start to realize that, oh, you know, maybe I should know more about them. You
right.
know? And then by the time it's too late. A lot of time, that's why this kind of project, or, you know, we'll give them, you know, little ideas, or sometimes you write something down, and you know, so they know where you came from. But, you know, I think it's true for all of us as a teenager, especially in this country, where there's so many things going on. There's so many, you know, there's a lot of peer pressure. There's a lot of things going on. They're really not interested in so much. We try to tell them, but sometimes they say that too much. They don't want to hear. But I'm sure in the end, later when they get a little older, their age, when they have children of their own, they're probably thinking, you know, I should know more.
Yeah.
And hopefully we're still around to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty much it for my questions. I appreciate you coming in. And
well, thank you. Thank you for having me, and I'm glad I'll be able to do more. But like I said, you know, there's a lot more thing to tell, and you try to wrap up things that have gone on for so many years in a couple of hours, and but just. So it, but again, it's a good thing that that people like me was allowed to come and be able to share that experience.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.